Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. Please visit us at connorsinstitute.org to sign up for our free email newsletter. While you are there, also be sure to check out all of our great research and resources.
Please listen carefully. Carefully.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the program. This is the Utterly Moderate Podcast, and I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Thank you so much for joining us on another episode. So we've talked a lot on this podcast about how both the left and the right wings in America are just bombarded with misleading information on a regular basis. On the left, unfortunately, a lot of this bad info comes from an academic research community which is overwhelmingly liberal. So a recent study that I often refer to found that the least imbalanced discipline was engineering, which was still 62% liberal professors. Political science was 89%. Psychology was 94%. My own discipline, sociology, 98%. And some disciplines had no Republicans at all. Now, this is, of course, just huge one-sidedness, and it means that the people doing the research, as well as the people checking it to make sure that it's high quality, all have similar and overlapping ideological blind spots. And this is unfortunately allowing too much misleading information to make it into the public discourse and be perceived by the average citizen as being backed by solid evidence. Well, on today's episode, I want to continue this conversation, and I'm joined by anthropologist Michael Gindra. He's from Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. He's here to talk about this problem and hopefully offer us some ways to save the social sciences from themselves. So thank you so much for joining us today on the program, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Lawrence.
Big fan of your perspective on this, and I think you're a good person to give us insight into this problem. So let's talk about what the problem is. So you've written a number of articles, and I'm going to link a few of them in the show description. One's called "When Ideology Drives Social Science, Statistical Malfeasance and Cherry Picking Are Rife." That was in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I'm shocked they even were willing to print that, but they did, which was nice. Different perspective there. But I'm going to read a quote here, and then we can dive into the conversation and you can tell us what the problem is. But you and your co-author wrote that, quote, "In complex areas like the study of racial inequality, a fundamentalism has taken hold that discourages sound methodology and the use of reliable evidence about the roots of social problems. We are not talking about mere differences in interpretation of results, which are common. We're talking about mistakes so clear they should cause research to be seriously questioned or even disregarded. A great deal of research rigs its statistical methods in order to arrive at ideologically preferred conclusions," end quote. Whew. So let's start with, what is this fundamentalism that you believe has taken over in many of the social sciences?
Briefly, I would say it's a real bias towards structural solutions. It's a bias toward looking at the systems and looking top down. There's a refusal to look at the whole variety of causes that go into social problems. And by that, I mean, if you want to study and understand any social problem, you have to look at not only structural, but also cultural and at the level of individuals. All three things are important and they all interact also, which makes it rather complex. And the bias right now is structural because, and this, we won't have to get into the details on this, but culture has been controversial for decades now. It comes back here and there. People realize that it's important. And then also at the individual level, you know, at the family level, what are the processes going on there? And a lot of this is interdisciplinary. And that's part of the problem too. You, to understand this, you have to be looking at all the disciplines, and the way academia is set up, it often doesn't really do that very well.
So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the big problems you mentioned is really, really important, which is, yeah, I mean, if you walk into any sociology class or anthropology class or political science class and, you know, on and on and on, you're going to find people, again, coming back to structural. I hear that word all the time, structural causes, you know, social forces, institutions, you know, the economy, the political system, et cetera. And I think it's important. I mean, I know you don't want to go too deeply in the weeds on this, so you go as deep as you want, but there is really a big taboo against ever blaming individuals or blaming, like you say, culture. You don't have to go too deep into it, but why do you think that is? I mean, there's a history there, of course, but why do you think, I mean, it's all, you can get in a ton of trouble even just suggesting that those levels are important when it comes to some social problems. So what's the history there? Why is that a problem?
People have written books about that. I mean, you've got, we've got a real orientation, and this isn't bad, of course, that's built up toward the disadvantaged and toward the people that have been discriminated against. And of course, that's progress. I mean, we've made a lot of progress with the civil rights movement and trying to help disadvantaged people. But it's gotten to the point where you see this, for instance, in the DEI and some of the more extreme DEI ideologies, where you divide the world into oppressor and oppressed. But people are realizing, wait a minute, this has gone too far. And people in the middle are saying, wait a minute, we can't divide the world that way. And there's a real, I think, impulse to put ourselves, and especially among the academic elite, to put ourselves on the side of truth and justice and on the side of the disadvantaged. And the impulse itself isn't bad, but as other people are writing about, that can cause problems like luxury beliefs, some say, where, well, we can't blame, we can't look at the issue of single parent families, right? Because that's putting them down. But the reality is that's a major issue. It seems to be a major cause of part of the social problems. And we have to look at how to address that. We can't simply avoid that. It's a lot easier to blame a system rather than people because that's not personalized. And everyone, the right and the left, they both love to blame the system. They like to blame politicians. And that's just not reality. I'm an anthropologist and I see, you know, we're all flawed in some ways, and you have to look at all of the levels. And you have to especially look at interactions and how we're socialized, especially at the family and the neighborhood level. That's absolutely key as far as education is concerned. For instance, you can't get kids educated very well unless they have some kind of stability in their family upbringing. Yes, school systems matter, teachers matter, things like that. But you get kids coming into kindergarten and first grade way behind already and just not ready for school. And so we're already losing it at the family level. But people don't want to look at that. People, you know, you don't want to put down groups that have higher rates of single family parenthood. I mean, African Americans have higher rates of single family parenthood. And of course, there are actually, you know, some structural causes for that. There's a big debate. There's a big argument. Does that go back to slavery or not? We don't have to get into that. But it's clear that it's not just the individual's fault. It is partly structural, but it manifests itself at the individual and at the family level. And so the solutions to that have to involve family. It has to involve somehow promoting good relationships, promoting good marriages so we can give kids stability, things like that. So it's intertwined, and people want to avoid the tougher solutions, I think, in favor of what they think are easier, but what I argue are often ineffective solutions from the top down.
Yeah, so you and your co-author, Arthur Sakamoto, you talk about how ideology is infecting all sorts of areas of research. And you aren't the only ones who've said this. Obviously, there's a number of people who've commented on this, but some of the areas where the most egregious mistakes are being made are areas where the researchers themselves are really emotionally invested in a particular outcome. So the study of like racial inequality and gender inequality are good examples. And now some of it's just sloppy research by people who are so ideological that they can't see the mistakes they're making in order to support a dominant narrative. Some of it's just malfeasance, though, and dishonest. So you talk about the model minority myth in some of your writings. So tell us, what is that myth, and what are some of the mistakes people are making, either intentionally or not?
Well, I got to do a shout out here to my co-author, Art Sakamoto, who's been studying this longer than I am. And he's a sociologist, and he's the statistical expert. He's been looking at this for a long time, and he's spotted a lot of these errors and he's in Asian American studies and in sociology. And he's noticed that, Asian Americans are the most successful group in the U.S., more than whites. But yet, as I mentioned earlier, there's such an impulse, there's such pressure to also portray them as a victim and as discriminated against. And so some feel uncomfortable with that status. And so they don't necessarily want to be put in the oppressor category. So that's some of the dynamics that are happening. So you can crunch numbers and you can find issues that might support the fact that Asian Americans are being discriminated against, perhaps in an area here or there. There was an upsurge after COVID in violence against Asian Americans, but I think Art has looked at it. I think a lot of that was exaggerated quite a bit. There's sometimes your reporting changes. People start reporting things that they didn't report before, so it's not really changes in what's actually happening. It's how people report them. There's all sorts of issues with that. So. That's one of the most, I think, visible areas where you really see problems, because Asian Americans are doing very well on a number of levels. At the family level, in marriage and family, they have very stable relationships, which helps their kids. They have problems too, of course. I mean, and there should be some, and I write about this in a forthcoming book, that the pressure that's often put on Asian American kids, there's a stereotype involved with that, of course, but there's a reality behind that stereotype. And that some find that very tough to expect to always get straight A's, to expect to go to Ivy League colleges, to expect to become doctors and lawyers. And so you have to talk about that also. But the reality is, if you're looking at socioeconomic outcomes and statistics, they're doing very well, extremely well, and it's hard to say that there being a model minority is a myth. I think we, the rest of society, can certainly learn things from what Asian Americans are doing. And of course, Asian Americans are a very diverse group. Not all of Asian Americans are doing as well as, say, South Asians or East Asians. And so that's what people often focus on, or some of the groups that actually aren't doing good, but these tend to be smaller groups. So yeah, it's a lot. It clearly is. The model minority myth is clearly a myth. I mean, you don't want to necessarily call them a model. You don't want to call any group a model, but we can certainly.
The underlying argument, sure. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But I mean, and again, I want to emphasize here, a difference in interpretation is one thing, right? So if somebody splices the data and says, look, these 45 groups, or however many there are, subgroups within Asian Americans, this number are doing well, but this number is facing job market discrimination, fine. All right, that's a different of interpretation of looking at subgroups. And that's a different problem, though, than some of the problems you guys have found, which is, somebody basing a whole book on like old newspaper articles, which themselves weren't relying on good data, right? Like, and then totally ignoring new peer-reviewed data. that's a different problem from just saying, well, I don't like the way that you've addressed this problem. That's just totally ignoring the literature that exists, right? And cherry picking, not just cherry picking from old data, but cherry picking from like newspapers and stuff that wasn't peer reviewed. And then you found another study where, and this happens a lot, where a researcher makes a claim and a conclusion that when your colleague and you go back and look at the model, they didn't find in the model itself. I think this was in the bamboo ceiling research. And then when called on the carpet, the person doubles down. So that's a different problem, right? I mean, and again, if it fits the narrative, oftentimes it's like it just kind of gets passed through.
Yeah, Art has been really good at finding these mistakes and errors and pointing this out. But there's such pressure to produce these kinds of narratives that and people don't get called on it. And so they do it and they get away with it. So they cherry pick data. And even if people criticize it, you know, their colleagues, the people that matter, their colleagues in their university and the journals don't really seem to care that much, which is frustrating.
So I want to ask you one more question about sort of methods and theory and interpretation, and then we'll talk a little bit about saving the social sciences, because if we don't do it, somebody's going to come in with a hammer and do it themselves, and they're going to break the whole thing. So I want to ask you, though, you made a point in one of your articles, and I can't remember which one it was, but you made a really interesting point that I've always assumed as a sociologist, but you're an anthropologist, so you can explain it to us. But you say that, you know, even the same groups of people on different areas of the globe who may face similar structural conditions are going to develop different cultures. They're different people. They're going to respond in different ways. Those cultures are going to be different. We can talk about what the value we placed on them, but they're going to be different and they're going to have different outcomes. Could you talk a little bit about that, the importance of the role of culture, why we shouldn't ignore it, and why you shouldn't just assume that it's like a math problem where you can say there's this social force, this structural force, therefore that have that outcome. There is that intervening variable, whatever you want to call it, of culture that plays an important role independent of everything else.
Yeah, I mean, that's been kind of my life project. I mean, right out of college, I'd come from a small town in Wisconsin, so I hadn't seen the world. Right out of college, I joined the Peace Corps. I went to Africa and spent a couple of years there. And that really, I had a sense even before that culture was key, but that really brought it home, right? Culture is absolutely crucial. And then I went back and that's when I decided to become an anthropologist at that point to look at it more intensely. So, I'm not a big fan of ranking cultures necessarily. Cultures
sure,
go
absolutely.
In very different directions, right? Cultures have different orientations toward different things. And just broadly, looking at our own culture, we've basically make an obsession out of economic productivity. We like economic growth. We work hard. We produce a lot and we accomplish a lot in that way. And I think we do it to an excessive degree, actually, because that can hurt community. It can hurt social relationships. It can hurt the environment, right? As we see now. But boy, it's really made us productive and it's made us wealthy and a lot and people can consume a lot. And most of us love that. We love our conveniences, right? In Cameroon, of course, they weren't very good at producing things, right? Their culture was more oriented towards sociality and toward community. So I loved being in the village. I loved hanging out with people there. And I studied death celebrations for my dissertation there. It's these big family events that get together and they're really amazing. Music and dancing and drinking and food, and they bring people together and there's such community there. Sure, there's problems, there's tensions, there's things like witchcraft that are happening, but that was their orientation. And a lot of Peace Corps volunteers loved that environment and didn't want to go back to the U.S. just because they felt so much of a community. And a lot of Peace Corps volunteers have issues with reverse culture shock coming back to places like the U.S. where they feel so alienated and where people are in such a rush. And so there's advantages and disadvantages. But if you want to look at the issue of the West and the rest, why did the West develop so much? Not only economic productivity and science, it's clear that culture played the absolute role there. And I think just to mention one scholar, Joseph Henrich at Harvard in his lab, he's got the book out, The Weirdest People in the World. And he's really, I think, nailed, it's a couple years old now, has really nailed why or how this happened historically over centuries, why the West developed very differently from other cultures. So, and I won't get into the details on that, but it's absolutely crucial. So, but there's still people that argue, for instance, well, if we just, you know, put enough aid in there, or if we just, you know, establish a democratic government, you know, we try to impose a democratic government on them. And we found like in Iraq and Afghanistan and even Vietnam, we tried that in the 60s, right? Culture is absolutely key why you simply can't do that. It's not to give up on things like that, but if you're looking at inequality, which is what I've been studying worldwide and even domestically, you have to look at different cultural orientations and what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a dangerous thing. I mean, I've had articles that I've submitted to journals where I have controlled for the things they wanted me to control for. So for instance, I study spatial inequality, and I use a lot of like Roz Chetty's IRS data and, you know, census data and things like that. And you find that when you control for as much as you can possibly control for responsibly, you know, you don't want to over control obviously, but when you responsibly control for as much as you can control for, you find that things like single parenthood in the communities ends up being really powerful above and beyond poverty, right? Because you've controlled for poverty and it's much more impactful for many outcomes than poverty is. And so it's clearly working independently. It's not you're poor and therefore you're single parents and that's why things are happening in a bad way. It's like, yeah, the poverty has its own independent impact, but single parenthood also, and in many cases, it's a greater impact, right? And I've submitted articles to journals with that finding, and I've had peer reviewers come back and say, well, until you fix the fact that you didn't account for poverty when poverty was in the model, because they were just so put off by mentioning single parenthood, right? And
save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I happen to think cancel culture has a huge chilling effect in our disciplines. Some people say that no, we're totally overemphasizing it. In fact, Lawrence Eppert, if you're saying cancel culture is a problem, you're just mad you can't say racist things anymore, right? But I guess I'll ask you, what's your perspective on that? You know, am I overemphasizing it, or is there a real chilling effect of avoiding some of these topics and that distorting our science?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been happening for decades. For instance, with the whole culture of poverty debate, I mean, people going back to the 60s and Daniel Patrick Moynihan's book was controversial at the time, and that had a chilling effect back then. And people have written books about the report, both negatively and positively, some of the books showing exactly the chilling effect that that had. It took William Julius Wilson later on to kind of say, wait a minute here, we shouldn't just totally rip that necessarily. He brings culture
back. He also
back.
Got blasted by
Yeah, he did. And he actually brings it back rather gingerly. He still kind of waffles a little bit. And I think even has more of a structural orientation than a cultural orientation. But he, you know, give him credit. I mean, he brought
back. He was
back
really and, scarred by the backlash he got.
Really? It was at the, see, I don't remember that exactly, but I'm, because I wasn't in sociology at the time. But yeah, so even him bringing it up, and it's still something you can't discuss without people getting all mad about, and it's really sad because I think it's really preventing us from looking at solutions that'll be more effective than some of the structural solutions. I mean, I think the argument of I just cannot be convinced by the basic income argument, right? That what I say is like throwing money at people is going to solve problems, and other people have written books about, you know, how it's not money. I forget what's the Susan Meyer well-known book, you know, money. I forget what the title is, but she just demonstrates that a lot of these issues, it's not just a matter of money. And I think people want to throw money at some of this stuff just because it makes them feel better or it's an easy solution. It'd be great if money could work and solve these issues. If it were that simple, we would have solved it a long time ago. But it's clear and I think, good sociologists and good anthropologists come together on this and say, look, a lot of this is social. It's how it's socialization. It's in these processes and how it's our peer groups and our neighborhoods that influence us. And no matter how much you throw money at it, if you don't look at those kinds of relationships, you're not gonna get at the problem very well. So, what was your original question again? Did I go off on a tangent?
I think you've answered it.
Yeah. I mean, I had just on the canceled question too. I was shocked just recently. I mean, I was talking to someone who I thought was he was another anthropologist at another university recently, and I complained about, people on the more conservative or even moderate getting canceled. And he said, it's kind of what you said. He said, the only people getting canceled are racists, right? And I was like, shocked. Yeah. And I thought, my gosh, he's a faculty member. So, would he defend a moderate? I don't know. It really, really scared me in some ways that he would have that attitude. I thought he was just blind or living in some kind of a bubble or something. If you look at FIRE, I mean, FIRE's data is good, and they'll show that. I mean, people on the especially with Israel Palestine, people on the left are being canceled too, unfortunately. And I'm for free speech. That shouldn't be happening on either side. But I think more people being canceled are clearly people on the right. That's just because the left tends to dominate universities.
My biggest concern, because I see so few people on the right in the universities, is that it's people in the universities who have good faith questions about dominant research and, dominant narratives, just afraid to talk about it. And if you talk to someone behind closed doors, you can find out about a lot of this stuff. But I think there's a real chilling effect. In fact, I was just watching an interview with Noam Chomsky the other day. I was trying to learn a little bit about why he signed the Harper's letter, which was a totally innocuous letter. It was just like, hey, let's not be illiberal. I mean, totally innocuous. And I don't want to put words in his mouth. You can go watch his interviews, but it's almost like he spends 2% of the time defending the letter and then 98% of the time disavowing it and saying, what I really meant was, the right sucks. And I was like, even to just sign something like that, it's like there's so much pressure to say, no, the right is the real problem, right? We have no problems on the left, no problems in academia, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten so polarized that all people want to do is attack the other side, and they don't want to grant anything. They don't want to have any nuance or to defend, and they don't want to be seen as defending the wrong side, no matter how right that may be at times.
Even among the truth seekers, yeah. So I want to ask you, I want to put a positive spin on this, because I happen to believe if we let the Christopher Rufos of the world and the Ron DeSantis's of the world and, Sarah Huckabee Sanders of the world, if you let them try to fix it, they're not good faith actors. They would like to come in and break the whole thing. And I don't want to do that. I think the social sciences are important. I think anthropology is important. Sociology is important. Political science, you name it, psychology, et cetera. But we have some real problems. And we could talk about specific mechanisms that are broken. I happen to believe the genesis of a lot of these things comes back to a single issue, which is lack of intellectual diversity, right? So in my own field, it's like 44-1. That means like less than 3% of sociologists are Republicans or are conservative. And I got to be honest with you, Mike, I've never met the one, at least that's publicly willing to say I'm a Republican. In the same study that I'm referencing, there was zero in your profession. Wow. Among the sample that they were looking at, of course. And again, I'm sure it's hard for you to find many, but I think, if peer review wants to get better, I think if the gatekeepers are more diverse, that would help. I think if we want to replicate studies, if there's more incentives, like a lot more intellectual diversity would help. So I think it comes up, a lot of those problems come back to the same issue of a lack of intellectual diversity. But I don't know about you. I mean, besides just, and look, Republicans aren't beating down the door to try to get into academia. So I don't even know how you create this diversity in the first place. But I would ask you, do you have any ideas for fixing this? Because we need to fix it. We need to stop the bad research, stop the big claims, stop the distortion of the public discourse. But any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any magic things about that. I think those on the left that currently dominate have to realize that viewpoint diversity is going to be good. I think it's wishful thinking. I think that's actually going to happen. There are some on the left that have said, wait a minute, this isn't good. I mean, Jonathan Haidt is kind of on the left a little bit, and maybe he's moved toward the center because he's seen, you know, what's been happening on the left. But once people say, look, we need to get other voices in here, that'll help. I think I cringe when I see what, you know, Rufo and DeSantis is doing. And this is in some ways, it's like maybe that'll have a good effect in the sense I don't want to see them entirely succeed and destroy everything. But people, the left has to realize that the funding to universities is going to be cut because the right can see through what's happening. I mean, they it's not like what we're talking about here and all the problems in academia and the stats. I mean, we're not making this up, and the right can use this as evidence to cut funding. And it's unfortunate, but if so much of the social sciences is producing crap, frankly, maybe some of the funding should be cut. Now, that's heresy for, fortunately, I'm not in a position where anyone's gonna cut me for saying that, but so much of that money is wasted on bad studies. And I think if the left wants to preserve good universities, they're gonna have to accept and allow more diverse voices in, because the right, some of these people on the right are gonna come in and they're gonna really reduce the systems and really break it up. And that's not gonna be good in the long run. Should trustees, whether we get in the nitty gritty, I think, I don't like state governments passing laws and it ends up, can the trustees at these universities say, wait a minute here now, we've got to start doing something and kind of work top down that way. How you're a president that's gonna really try to promote viewpoint diversity. A lot of times these decisions on who to hire, and I've seen this in departments, right? We want to hire someone who fits in. I've heard the language at some of the places I've been. We want to find the right fit. And that's usually someone that agrees with them already. So I've seen how this process works. And I think, presidents and provosts and others are going to have to start talking to departments and saying, look, you cannot hire, you've got to actually start getting some viewpoint diversity, like they've done with ethnic diversity and other kinds of diversity. You've got to start allowing people in who are going to challenge you to a certain extent. I don't know. Good luck with that, maybe. That's idealistic even to say that. But I can, if that happens, that's what you, if you don't want the coming top down passing state laws, you've got to start doing something like that, I think.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain. I've been trying to mull this over for a long time because, it's not as if we advertised a position here tomorrow, we would not get very many conservative applications, if any, right? So it's not as if we're turning them away. And yeah, of course, we end up hiring the most extreme person who fits, our narrative and that kind of stuff. But even then, let's say we didn't, right? Like, let's say you just threw a stone into the application pool. Like, you're more likely than not to find somebody who's liberal, like overwhelmingly so. And the problem is so complicated because, like, when I talk to my colleagues around the country, I'm not just talking about my own department, but around the country about certain topics, like, they think I'm a right-wing nut, right? Like, when I just mention certain things. So I was talking to a colleague once who was at a school where a gender clinic was shut down, right? And the gender clinic had legitimately been doing some really bad stuff, right? They hadn't been vetting people to see if they had true gender dysphoria. It could have been other, mental health challenges. It could have been that they were gay, right? And that they hadn't made their way through puberty yet. I mean, there was some bad stuff happening legitimately that had been verified by legitimate sources. And this person was at the institution itself and just rejected it. Oh, that's just a right-wing smear. Right. I mean, I have colleagues who, when I say, hey, there's like these two high quality trans suicide studies, one says in Finland says they're not at a higher risk, or at least it's not due to their gender identity. And then one from Denmark says they are. Man, we really need to figure this out. And they say, oh, no, the one study's bad, the one study's good. Right. Like, we don't even see the problem is what I'm saying. There's not a lot of people who are different from us who want to be in the profession, number one. And the people in the profession are having a hard time even seeing there's a problem. Like, me, you and I are rare, I think.
Yeah. And it is tough because you're right. You're not getting applications from people who are more moderate or conservative. You know, undergrads go to these courses, and some of these courses are taught by people who just try to indoctrinate them. So it produces acolytes. I've seen this in departments too. It produces students become acolytes of a certain charismatic leftist professor, and they gravitate. No, I'm going to study sociology because I'm going to change the world and social justice and all this. And conservatives are turned off. So it happens, you know, at the undergraduate level in classes, and it's a bad cycle. You have stereotypes of lefty professors among conservatives, and they don't like these disciplines and avoid them. And so, yeah, it's going to be real, real tough.
Well, I'm with you. If we don't fix it, they're going to come in from the top down, and they're going to come in swinging. So we better do it ourselves. But hey, the fact that you're bringing attention to it, the fact that you're interested in it, I should ask you before you go, I've kept you longer than I promised you, but I've got to ask you, what led you down this road in the first place? I mean, all of us had some awakening, like, wait, we got a problem here. What was it for you? You know, I mean, I came out of grad school. I was a lefty. I believed we were telling the truth. And then I started seeing little things like, oh, that's not the truth. That's not the truth. What was your awakening?
There's a number of things. I mean, frustration. I go back to, I think it was the late 90s, and welfare. So welfare reform was passed in 1996. And if I'm right, 94, yep. I think it was 96. And I went to a session at AAA, which is the American Anthropological Association National Conference, big conference. Back then, it was like 5,000 people. I think it's a lot less now. It's the whole, you know, kind of shows the discipline. Anyway, there was a panel on the welfare reform laws, maybe a couple of years after it passed. And it was just like a chorus, right? It was like, how this is so bad, and it's just terrible. And it was just unanimous. There were no voices that actually were showing. And at that time already, evidence was coming out that, hey, you know, a lot of people were getting off of welfare. They were getting jobs. I know the overall result is a bit mixed, but I think in general, the consensus was that it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, that it was at least partly successful, that the dependence of a lot of people on welfare pre-96 wasn't necessarily good. There was nothing in this session that showed that. It was all kind of like preaching to the choir. And I said, oh man, you know, what is going on here? And so ever since, you know, so I think about that. And ever since then, I've said, you know, with anthropology at least, and I've been involved in sociology just as much as anthropology. I've just seen this time and time again in other issues. So it's been going on for quite a while.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, our house is just as dirty as yours. So if not worse. Yeah. Anyway, Michael Gindra, he's an anthropologist at the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs at Boston University. We will link his work in the show description. He's going to have a chapter coming out in a book of mine that I'm trying to get the publisher to accept. They're a little bit ginger about criticizing the left, but we'll see how it goes. But anyway, Mike, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thanks, Lawrence. This was actually great. I appreciate what you're trying to do here. This is wonderful. Thank you, Lawrence.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until
Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.